All right. And Jack Cochran, Jack Ross, Jack Harris, and the Camilo James, Ian Cochran, presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Thank you. Welcome to this session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which is being held in Rochester. I want to start out by thanking the court staff here at the Olmsted County Government Center for helping us out with oral arguments here today. We have four cases on our calendar. Second to get settled here, and then we'll get started. Good morning to council. The first case on our calendar today is A23-1301, State of Minnesota versus Lionel Bailey. As you know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock, so you can see how much time you have remaining. And we do ask that you introduce yourself and the party you're representing at the beginning of your argument. We are recording the oral arguments here today, so that will be helpful for purposes of the recording. Counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
What should I just point this toward me then, I guess?
Yes, I believe so.
It's just strangely situated.
That work okay?
I'll say it does if you think so.
All right. Can everyone hear counsel okay?
Sounds like it's picking up your voice.
Well, I don't think I'm going to have to speak very loudly. Anyway, I'll begin. Good morning. May it please the court.
Full counsel.
My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Lionel Bailey. Two issues brought on this appeal are primarily that there's insufficient evidence to sustain the convictions for the attempted murder and drive-by shooting at a person charges. Secondarily, a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel based on the concession of the underlying offenses of assault to and drive-by shooting without Mr. Bailey's express or implied consent. On the first issue, I have in my brief to the court cited the standard for circumstantial evidence review. I think it's safe to say, however, that I've primarily asserted that having read this transcript over and over, there simply was no evidence ever presented at trial in this case that a person was shot at, much less the complaining witness, Mr. Boynton. The evidence the state had consisted primarily of a video that showed the parking lot of the Holiday convenience store. The camera pointed, I believe, north, and at a certain point, a person that everyone agreed was Mr. Boynton ran into the camera frame right by the car that Mr. Bailey was apparently in. And he was running, as the video showed. He then kept running out of the frame to the left towards the street, I guess would be to the west. And according to his testimony, was apparently in the process of crossing the street when he heard shots behind him. There were numerous interviews at the scene of people in the store. None of them saw what anyone was shooting at. They only heard the shots. The video, of course, showed the person in the passenger seat, again, apparently Mr. Bailey. At some point after Mr. Boynton ran out of the screen, point a gun out the window in a westerly direction. By my count, looking at the video very carefully, Mr. Boynton was off the screen about 13 seconds, again, while he was trotting or running, before I saw a recoil on the pistol.
Counsel, don't we also have in the record Mr. Boynton's testimony that he believed the bullets passed close to him as he felt something come right close to his gut.
Well, that is certainly in the record, but I think that it was ably dealt with by defense counsel, who in cross-examination established from Mr. Boynton that he was, quote, not sure that he could feel bullets going past his body.
But we do know bullets were fired from the car. That's a circumstance proved.
We do, and we do. And the circumstance proved after that is that they hit a house, not a person. We know that he acknowledged that what he could have felt while he was running was his shirt rubbing against his belly, which again seems to defy common sense in that if he is claiming that he felt something actually rub against him, I think a moving bullet would have left a wound. And finally, when asked how close he thought the bullets were to you, he conceded, I don't know. So as I've argued in my brief, Mr. Boynton himself contradicted the patently absurd assertion that he could feel bullets moving past him. I went into that at length during my brief. By the time he even heard the shot report behind him, the bullets were already lodged in the house. It's simply not possible for a person to feel a tiny bullet the size of a peanut moving 1,500 feet per second going by your body. And
we don't have any, there isn't any testimony to that effect in the record.
There is, because Mr. Boynton himself acknowledged he doesn't know how close the bullets came to him, and he's not sure that he actually felt. I mean, if he felt something on his skin, it was his shirt.
But as to the scientific physical assertion that you just made, there's nothing in the record. There's no expert testimony about whether a person can or cannot feel the passing bullet.
It was not elicited, but I must assert that for a circumstance to be considered proved, it has to have a factual basis. And the state did not establish factually how a person could feel a bullet going past them. And Mr. Boynton himself contradicted, or at least sufficiently undermined, such an absurd claim by saying he doesn't know. In the second part of my argument, I also point out that Mr. Boynton had to acknowledge that he acknowledged at the scene to Officer Parker that he didn't even know if he was being shot at. So there are too many contradictory or countering facts to this notion, which the state put a great deal of emphasis on, that Mr. Boynton somehow felt bullets moving past him at well over 1,000 feet per second. And that was sufficiently undermined and contradicted by Mr. Boynton himself. When you take that away, there's nothing left to establish that a person was shot at here. There never was, which I think ties into my second argument about the ineffective assistance of counsel. I did provide some cases in my brief in which there were examples of how a person could tell they were being shot at. Usually it's because they could see the person shooting at them, or there could be other things like bystander witnesses who observed it, perhaps a surveillance video. All of that is absent here. I could note that when this case was first charged, I think I had seen that it was either a mistaken charge or it was actually the original charge, and then it was quickly changed from drive-by shooting of a building under that subparagraph of the paragraph to the drive-by of a person, which I think is section A. Drive-by shooting of a building is all that was actually established by the evidence for that count. And once that's established, there can't be an attempted murder. If this conviction is affirmed, it would effectively affirm and allow the idea that any bystander who happens to be near a vehicle or a building that is being shot at can claim that that person shooting was attempting to murder them simply because they were in proximity to what was actually hit by the shots. I think that that is insupportable from an evidentiary point of view, a legal point of view, and a public policy point of view.
Skipping over to your to the or the second part of the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, the acquiescence in the defense or in the alleged concession. You agree that's a matter. Your brief refers to it as the district court being making an erroneous conclusion. You agree that it's the clear error standard that would apply to that factual question as to acquiescence? Or do you believe it's a matter of law?
I have to ask for clarity, though. Are you, you're referring to the post-conviction court
yes.
decision? I believe so, yes.
Clear error.
I believe I would defer to the, I can't think precisely of what standard I cited in my brief, but if the-
Well, you just mentioned erroneous and it didn't develop the clear error. I'm wondering what would be the, what's your best argument for us to agree that the district court clearly erred in finding that your client acquiesced?
The main point there is what I'm relying on, I think, from State v. Powers, that that decision and others have held that in order to find acquiescence as opposed to express agreement with concessions of elements, it has to have been the continuous, and I would emphasize the word continuous, defense strategy from start to finish to concede certain elements of an offense. And what the post-conviction, I think, clearly erred on was in discounting or flatly ignoring the portions of the record that I cited in which, prior to the trial beginning, the defense successfully opposed the admission of any tracking testimony from a police officer. I mean, I think the state ultimately agreed to withdraw such testimony because the district court was signaling it wouldn't allow it. But that, to me, was the foundation of the defense.
But the at trial, I mean, isn't the question whether the defendant acquiesced in the position from the beginning of end to from the beginning of the trial to the end of the trial?
No, I think what the language I've quoted from the cases is that what the defense strategy was. First, the defense strategy has to be identified. Then it is assessed as to whether there was acquiescence from the defendant. And the strategy has to be consistent for there to be deemed acquiescence.
Well, once you succeed on that motion, then you, as defense counsel, then you formulate your strategy going forward. So I'm not sure how the two are necessarily inconsistent, succeeding on that motion and then having a strategy at trial that describing Bailey as a scapegoat, which I think the record reflects was the strategy from the beginning of the opening until the closing argument.
Respectfully, it was not, ma'am.
But I mean, going back to my, I guess, question for you is, if you succeed in that motion, isn't it appropriate then for defense counsel to adopt a strategy based on your success in that motion? And if there's no objection to that ongoing strategy, isn't that acquiescence?
No, because the defense continued to display the strategy of challenging whether Mr. Boynton was actually shot at during the trial with the two main witnesses, establishing first that Mr. Boynton, he was directly asked, "You don't know if you were shot at, do you?" And he agreed, "I don't know." He agreed he wasn't looking when the shots were fired. He was asked about bullets supposedly coming close enough for him to feel them, and he said, "I'm not sure." So co-counsel actually established that with Mr. Boynton. But I think even more significantly, she established with Officer Parker on his cross-examination that Mr. Boynton told him at the scene, "I don't know if I was shot at." That's not consistent with a sudden concession and closing argument that Mr.
Well, was it really sudden? Because the trial transcript shows that in defense's opening, co-counsel described Bailey as a convenient scapegoat for a scared and self-interested getaway driver.
I have not at any point asserted in here that the defense wasn't pursuing both the scapegoat or identity issue on the one hand and challenging that Mr. Boynton was even shot at on the other. Those are actually the proper way to challenge a case like this, challenge both identity and the fact that an assault or a drive-by shooting a person even occurred. That's exactly how it was laying out until the abrupt, complete concession during closing argument right at the end, where he told the jury, did an assault occur here? Did a drive-by shooting person here? Absolutely it did. I mean, Mr. Bailey could not have acquiesced to that if co-counsel had already ably established on the cross of Mr. Boynton and Officer Parker that they didn't know he was shot at. Combine that with the pretrial motion to prevent any tracking testimony. That, to me, was the clearer strategy to challenge not just identity, but that Mr. Boynton was a victim at all. So once you then look at the fact, I mean, I feel like I'd like to address the main part of the post-conviction court's argument, where he found that no elements were actually conceded. The main thing I wanted to come here and say today was that I don't think the order from the post-conviction court is consistent with Torres and Dukes 2 at 621 Northwest 2nd, because the issue examined in Torres, after they dealt with the identity issue, was there was also a question asserted about whether counsel had conceded that a burglary had occurred, the underlying offense to the murder, that was independent of the issue of identity. It was whether the defense had admitted that a burglary had actually occurred, which was a predicate for the murder there, just like the assault and the drive-by here were a predicate for the attempted murder.
So in that view, you're suggesting then that the post-conviction court's focus on the jury instructions and the defendant being included as an element in each one of the defendant being the subject in each one of the elements, you would say that that's not enough because of the alternative theory of the prosecution.
I would rely on the express language of Torres and Dukes too, which, may I continue?
You may.
Which both analyzed the issue from whether an underlying offense had occurred, independent of the identity issue. I would note from the jury instructions that were given, certainly on the part of attempted murder while committing drive-by shooting, the district court began by saying that the state not only had to prove intent, but all the elements of a drive-by shooting. And the Dukes and the Torres court did not tie the issue of conceding elements to also conceding identity.
So counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, but on rebuttal, if you're familiar with the State v. Huisman case, Huisman 944 Northwest 2nd, 464, I would appreciate discussing that case with you, because that case, I think, clarifies Torres.
Could you please give me that site again, and then I'll have my seat?
Yes, it's 944 Northwest 2nd, 464.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, thank you, sorry.
You're not sharing?
I'm not opposed to sharing, but I did bring my own. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. I did want to point out a typographical error that occurred in the amended complaint that made its way into my brief. I don't think it affects our analysis here at all, but there was some amended complaints, and in the count two of the amended complaint, which is attempted murder, just straight attempted murder, the charge descriptor included that language about attempting to commit a drive-by shooting. That's another variant of the murder in the second degree. That's just a typographical error.
And what page are you on?
On page two of my brief, I just simply listed the charges as listed in the complaint. It accurately cites the charges as they were stated in the complaint. But it dawned on me this morning that that charge descriptor that made its way into that amended complaint is just an error. The statutory citation is correct. Mm-hmm. 60919 subdivision 1, parent 1. That's correct. And the jury was properly instructed. There's no issue, but it caused me to scratch my head this morning. If it caused the same confusion to the court, I apologize, but I just bring that to the court's attention.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off with talking about the sufficiency of the evidence in this case. Mr. Bailey, for purposes of our appeal, concedes at least that he was the person in the car firing the bullets for purposes of our sufficiency analysis. The only real question is, was the evidence sufficient to support the jury's verdict that he intended to shoot and hit and harm and effectively kill Jared Boynton? I think the exhibit at trial that's going to be the most helpful for us is Exhibit 18. It's the map of Rochester. I have a copy here in my hand just for reference, and I know the court has it. That map is oriented properly, by the way. North is north. I think it's inferred from the testimony there, but it is what it purports to be. And the address of 718 North Broadway, as was described in the testimony, is right on the corner of in that southeast quadrant of the intersection of Broadway and 8th Street Northeast. So what we do know, what the circumstances proved are, is we know where Mr. Bailey was seated in the car outside the Holiday Station. It's just south of the station. In fact, on Exhibit 18, which is, you know, not a snapshot at that time. It's just, probably a Google map. But there is a car parked effectively right in the same parking spot or maybe next to it where Mr. Bailey was seated. And 718 North Broadway is the house that's the farthest north on the 700 block, right in the corner of 8th Street and Broadway. And the direction, or if you will, the azimuth, is roughly 40, 45 degrees. So we know the trajectory of the rounds. We know that at least three rounds struck that house, and we know where they were fired from. So we know the path of the bullets. Now, Mr. Boynton testified that he had parked his car near the McDonald's on North Broadway. Now, that McDonald's is not on the map. It's farther north on Broadway on the east side. So he would have had to cross Broadway and make his way north. So the likely path he was taking was traveling to the east and northeast, if you will.
Also, did anyone testify to the path that he was traveling? It seems to me the issue about intent is that you demonstrate intent by the direction in which the bullets traveled and the behavior of Mr. Bailey afterwards, honking the horn and trying to get out. That seems to be the two major parts to show intent. Is there anything in the record that established that Mr. Bailey was actually traveling in that direction? Excuse me, Mr. Boynton.
Mr. Boynton. Yeah. Well, he testified, he was going to his car because he was going to give this fellow a ride. We know the car was parked on the east side of Broadway, and we know it's to the north. And there was no testimony that he made some deviance to that path. He didn't go south. He didn't go west. I think counsel may have just inadvertently misspoke. He's traveling to the east and to the north. Now, you know, this is later at night, traffic is light. I think a jury can reasonably infer that people try to take the closest path. And if that means maybe angling a little bit across the street, I mean, he's already admitted that he's effectively, you know, jaywalking here. We know he comes across and he says, I stepped out into the street. He's making his way to the car. And I think from that testimony, it's a fair inference that he is, you know, making his way across Broadway. And I think it's a very reasonable inference for the jury to infer, as the state argued, that Mr. Boynton would be right in the trajectory, right in the beaten zone of the rounds that we know traveled in that at that angle and impacted that house. So that's just, it's one of the circumstances proved, but I think that's an important fact. And I urge you to study the map on Exhibit 18 as it bears on the testimony. I do think that Mr. Boynton's testimony about what he felt is important and compelling. He described it the best way he could. He said, it's like when I played baseball. And that ball came too close, you could feel it. And he described it really probably in the best way he could, in something that he had experienced, and something, frankly, probably maybe jurors may have experienced in their own lives.
So, counsel for appellant argues that his testimony was not specific enough in that, you know, he didn't see the bullet, I think counsel's arguing that it could have been his shirt or the rain. So is his testimony, does it support a rational alternative inference?
Well, I think
that it may not have been a bullet, but something, what he felt might have been his shirt.
Well, I think it's an honest answer. One can't necessarily see a bullet. It's traveling too fast, and that's an honest answer. I think he answered honestly to say, well, I don't know for sure. We know he heard the shots. He said he felt something. And we know the path the bullets are traveling. So when you take all those circumstances and you put them together and look at them in the light most favorable to the verdict, I think these are all fair and reasonable inferences that support the verdict.
Is it objectively incredible that an individual can feel the passage of a bullet, not near the head, but near the torso, when the bullet is not even close enough to penetrate clothing?
Well, you're talking to someone who spent 20 years in the Marine Corps. So, I mean, there's no testimony to that, but I'd beg to differ about that sort of thing. I would hazard a guess that one would feel that sort of thing. But again, that's beyond the scope. I think the jurors can draw upon their own life experience about firearms and objects passing by them, whether it be baseball, a slower, much larger projectile, or much higher velocity projectile, such as a round from a firearm. But I think Mr. Boynton described it in the best way that he could under the circumstances. I think he was candid and honest. I mean, no, he can't say it for 100% sure that was a bullet. We can't freeze time like these movies. But
and he did, I think, say he felt something come right close to his gut.
That's what he said. Right close. He said it was like, I editorialized, but it's like an inside fastball. You know what that's like. It's just coming right by you. I think that's what he's trying to describe when that ball is coming by, and that was the sensation that he felt. But it's not unreasonable when we know through objective, evidence, we know the path those rounds, at least three of them, maybe other rounds took other paths, but at least three of them were right in that path where we would have expected him to be. So I guess, in sum total, I think the circumstantial evidence is there. A couple other points that I noted in the case law as I was preparing is the number of shots too. Mr. Boynton described, he says, I was stepping out into the street and I heard the first shots. And he testified something to the fact that I thought it might've been firecrackers, but then he's like, mate, those are shots.
How does the number of shots support a reasonable inference that the shots were intended to hit Mr. Boynton?
Because what he said next, Your Honor, was that that's when I started running. I was stepping out into the street. I hear the first couple shots and it dawns on me, somebody's shooting. And that's when I start running. And that's when I feel the shots coming by me. If Mr. Bailey's intent was to scare somebody away, he had accomplished that by the first few rounds. And in fact, this person was running away from him. The fact that he then unleashed a second barrage of shots, the shots that then, that's when Mr. Boynton says, that's when I felt things coming by me, indicates that his intent is not simply just to randomly fire shots or to scare someone away. He's actually seeking to acquire that target and hit it. It's not just to scare, it's to shoot. And the number of rounds also bolsters the jury's conclusion that he intended to harm and kill him, because he didn't do it the first time. It obviously he didn't fall, and it would appear that he hadn't hit the target.
Could we turn to the ineffective assistance of counsel issue? And on the question of acquiescence, can you address appellant's argument that there was a change in strategy by defense counsel when defense counsel made the statement in closing that there was, did this shooter commit a drive-by shooting? Yes, no question. Did the shooter commit assault in the second degree? Yes, no question. But is this anywhere near attempted murder? No, absolutely not. Where's the gun? Where's the shooter? So, and I think appellant was arguing that during the trial at cross-examination, defense counsel was asking questions to undermine the theory that Boynton was the intended target of the shots. And so is that statement in closing inconsistent with the earlier trial strategy?
Well, you know,
an abrupt change in strategy such that there can't be acquiescence.
Well, we had a full evidentiary hearing where, you know, Mr. Gifford testified, and Judge Chase probed extensively as to the trial strategy and that sort of thing. And I think Mr. Gifford testified very credibly that their strategy from the very outset was that Mr. Bailey was not the shooter. That was what their client wanted. They forfeited opportunities for maybe voluntary intoxication, self-defense, other sort of defenses that would require him to put himself in the car. Mr. Bailey said, nope, I wasn't there. I'm not the shooter. That's the defense that he wanted. And that was plain from the opening statement where Ms. Hansen conceded Mr. Boynton is the individual that the shooter shot at. That was right up front in the opening statement where she characterized Mr. Brown as effectively a liar who pinned this on Mr. Bailey as a convenient scapegoat. That was the defense strategy from the outset. It continued through the trial and was consistent at closing. Now, you can't fault defense counsel for poking other holes in the state's case, saying, well, my client wasn't the shooter, but whoever this guy was, you know, there's not enough evidence to show he intended to hit him or kill him. That's a fair argument, and you can't fault them for that. But it's truly an alternative, oh, by the way, sort of an argument that doesn't take away.
Doesn't that argument, though, conflict? I mean, and when I looked at that, my question was, don't the statements admit that there was an intentional firing by someone? And isn't that, even though it may not be the defendant particularly, isn't that an element, an underlying element in order to support the defendant's guilt?
Well, it certainly undermines a sort of a fallback argument that says, look, my guy wasn't even there.
Right.
But if you don't believe that, he didn't intend to kill him. Yeah, I can't disagree with that, that it certainly undermines a fallback argument.
Don't you need acquiescence in the relinquishment of the fallback argument if an element is being admitted defeat that fallback argument?
And that's the finding that the post-conviction court made. After one, first of all, Judge Chase was the trial judge. So he heard the evidence, he heard the case and saw for himself and got to be there and got to feel and sense that argument and see it. Then he got to hear the testimony of Mr. Gifford describing their strategy. And it was Judge Chase's findings of fact, which I would argue are not clearly erroneous, that in fact was the trial strategy, that Mr. Bailey was aware of it, that he never objected, and that he in fact acquiesced to that strategy.
But I gather then, and correct me if I'm wrong, you'd have to acknowledge that that was an admission of an element of the, you know, that defeats the fallback defense, which if I'm correct about that, doesn't that require the state if the state were to prevail then on the issue, it has to be on the question of acquiescence.
May I answer the question?
Yes, you may.
My time being up. Our position is that Mr. Gifford did not concede guilt. And that is the position and standard we take. Did he concede partial elements of some offenses? Yes. And would that negate their ability to present that as a fallback? Yes, that's correct.
And if that's the case, acquiescence then is the only defense or the only prevailing position for the state on the post-conviction claim. Or ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
I guess our position is conceding guilt. I guess the question would be, and it'll be up to the court to decide, is conceding an element alone sufficient to meet that standard? And I guess I'll leave that question to the court. Our position is he didn't concede guilt, but he may have conceded alternatively an element. But again, in the context of I wasn't even there, our position is that's just not a meaningful concession that would violate this ineffective assistance of counsel context. But and I'll leave that to the court then.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. And since I was asked, I'll just begin with the Hoosman case.
Yeah, and if I may, I would like you to focus on the language on page 468, where the
indeed
the court is clarifying Torres.
And I noticed immediately upon looking at it that that case is immediately and easily distinguishable. What the Hoosman court was wanting to emphasize was that simply conceding some elements would not be conceding guilt under Torres, where the elements that were conceded were not in dispute. That is the key distinction here. The elements of whether there was an assault and a drive-by shooting were disputed at trial with the pretrial motion to bar the tracking testimony and the questions that co-counsel asked of Mr. Boynton and Officer Parker, establishing that Mr. Boynton did not know that he was even shot at. Now, since respondent counsel cited his experience, I would just like to take a minute to point out that I too served in the military, and I happened to go through basic and police academy with a Marine platoon. We had Marine and Air Force instructors tell us that they were no longer going to give us the live fire drill. That's what they used to do because we had to do an exercise where you crawled under barbed wire and they would shoot over your heads. They said, we can't do that anymore. It's not safe enough. But the main thing I remember them telling us was, if a bullet is ever going to come near you or hit you, you won't know it until it hits you. This testimony from Mr. Boynton was about what he felt, not what he could sense. He said he felt something against his skin. If a bullet even slightly grazes you, whether it's from a pistol or a rifle, it is going to leave anything from an abrasion to a laceration. It will injure you. All Mr. Boynton felt was his shirt. That's the only possible explanation from this evidence. You can't feel a bullet going by you even an inch away. It's too small and it's moving too fast.
So I'm sure both counsel would agree that our review is limited to the record before us.
I just took some liberty there, and I apologize.
We can all go out to the range and just test this theory.
But turning back to the Hoisman case, I understand the manner in which you're trying to distinguish Hoisman, but I was focused more on the language, the Supreme Court's language in discussing Torres, and it says, we did not say and clarify today that we did not mean to say that an unconsented to concession on any single element necessarily is a concession of guilt. And it doesn't say of an undisputed element. It just says of an element.
Well, but I think it does, because that is what the-
And it says, we decline Hoisman's invitation to announce that rule of law. And then it similarly, they go on to decline the state's invitation to announce a rule of law that only a concession on each and every element of a crime is a concession of guilt. And then they talk about, they, you know, go on to analyze the facts of that case. But the what they're announcing isn't tied to it being an undisputed element.
Except for the fact that that's exactly what they tied it to in the next paragraph. That statement can't be read in isolation. The Supreme Court in Hoosman did not want to say that only conceding some elements would never be an example of improperly conceding elements. They wanted to say that it could not be a strict rule. And the reason it can't be a strict rule is because that in Hoosman, the elements that defense counsel conceded were uncontested. That is a crucial distinction between what happened in Torres, where it was supposed to be contested that a burglary occurred. In this case, everybody is agreeing that the record showed it wasn't supposed to be contested, the elements that were conceded. That's the vital and essential way to show what Hoosman does to distinguish Torres. I mean, if we go with just that first sentence, then Torres would have to be overruled. It would be overruled, but it's not. It's simply distinguished, as I'm doing here.
Thank you.
And in my remaining time, I just wanted to address the fact that there is no evidence, as counsel suggested, that Mr. Bailey wanted to scare anyone. No testimony was ever offered on that. And Mr. Bailey sat through that trial and watched his attorneys challenge both identity and the assault and the drive-by through the questions of Officer Parker and Mr. Boynton. That's why the concession during closing was so sudden and dramatic, just from me reading the record. It conceded elements without his implied or expressed consent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments and the briefing in this matter. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.